to have him here, Dr. Franz Prinzen.
Thank you. I first like to take the opportunity to make an advertisement for this very nice conference coming up this year, the Cardiovascular System Dynamics Society. I am the current president of the society, and that only means that we have to organize the meeting, so it's a great honor. I think it's for this audience a very interesting meeting. As I said, it's a society. Ned Rachel reminded me that the society started 35 years ago with people working on the ballistocardiography and things like that. Sander Kovacs explained yesterday that the heart is suspended nicely and that you don't move too much if your heart is beating. Well, ballistocardiography is about the little change in weight you have because the heart is beating. If you are standing on a very sensitive scale, you will see your body weight change a little bit with every heartbeat, and that was where ballistocardiography was about. Well, we have better measures now, but anyway, now we are, people in the society are trained in biophysics, bioengineering, physiology, and clinical medicine, so it's a whole wide range. But I can tell you that modeling and measurement are an important part of that. And for the young people here, it's interesting to see that for you that there are three competitions for young investigators. So here's some nice work done. Maybe interesting to ask your boss to go there. This is the website, so you're most welcome. And it will be in a very nice place, as you see, near Maastricht in the Netherlands. So, my talk is about electrical activation and mechanics, and I mentioned measurements and modeling during ventricular pacing. And you could ask, why is this topic in this meeting? Well, I have several reasons why people have invited me. But important to see is that ventricular pacing is becoming increasingly clinically irrelevant. Already there for a long time, but as you will see, things are changing quite rapidly in more than one sense. And it also turns out to be scientifically very tempting because the changes you see during pacing are tremendous. And so you can use all kinds of measurements and see very interesting things. So the measurements are interesting, and as it turns out, models can be very useful. And so rather than taking you through one kind of technique, I will take you with this topic through different techniques and approaches. So, for the people who are not really familiar with physiology in the heart, I'm a physiologist, and so the heartbeat starts at the sinus node, and the impulse is conducted through this rapid conduction system to activate the heart. This is the anatomy, the sinus node here. It generates about every second the impulse. It's conducted through the AC to the AV node. There's a delay. This is the conduction system. The Purkinje fibers, they end actually in what is called a few thousand Purkinje myocardial junctions. There the impulse is entering the working myocardium. And as you will see, that's a very important part with pacing. So again, to repeat, and this is the ECG, you see spreading through the two bundle branches very quickly, and then the two ventricles are activated, and also the all the myocytes are activated within a fairly short time, as you also see from the narrow QRS complex on the ECG. So this is the normal situation, and then you see every second there's about this is heartbeat. So what happens in, for example, a disease like AV block, where the atrial ventricular node is diseased, its conduction is blocked, the atrium is activating itself regularly, but the ventricle is not connected electrically. It generates its own beats, but you see that the ventricular rate is much lower, can drop to 30 or lower, and for many people that's a problem. They faint or they develop heart failure. And so the pacemaker is meant in the old fashioned way to, this is already a modern one, you can pick up with an atrial lead the impulse from the atrium. It's sent to the pacemaker, and the pacemaker stimulates the ventricle. The pacemaker is currently put 99% of the time in the right ventricular apex for practical reasons. And it can restore, in this manner, the regular rate again. So this is the effect of ventricular pacing. You restore your normal ventricular activation and beating rate. There's, however, a side effect, which is not unimportant, and that is that the stimulation here is not picked up by the Purkinje system, and so the conduction has to occur through the normal working myocardium, and that conduction is much slower, and that is expressed by widening in the QRS complex. So the QRS duration approximately doubles when you are being paced. That is known by the electrophysiologist, but kind of neglected. This is how it started all 50 years ago. First pacemakers, they were, well, you see, quite huge in the beginning, and essentially not more here in this stage than electrical giving a stimulus every second or so without paying attention to the atrial rhythm. It got smaller, but still extracorporeal. But then there's a huge development with all kind of funny prototypes and types. And this is one of the bigger and older implantable pacemakers with a lot of batteries. As you see here, this is a modern one. I like this one, which is rechargeable, but seems to be that it's difficult to see the difference between the inside and the outside of the pacemaker. And they even have pacemakers in China in those days. And so if you see all these things, this is funny. There's a lot of development. This is the current status, some things. And so pacemakers are implanted below the chest. The leads are put through the subclavian vein into the right heart, one in the atrium usually and one in the ventricle. And that's how it works. And it looks nice, it's small, and so pacemakers is really one of the first widely used devices. And you have all kinds of cartoons showing the appreciation of the general public about this technology, and also this kind of music players. It's the pacemakers is something to be proud of and have fun about. However, the widening of the QRS complex with pacing also turns out to have some negative effects, and it was already recognized by Wiggers in 1925 when he did one of the first experiments in an animal with pacing. It was a rather uncontrolled way, but one of the registrations showed that this is a sinus beat, this is a pace beat. You can hardly see it from the widening of the QRS complex here, but you see the significant drop in left ventricular and aortic pressure here. Well, many people have repeated that observation. We did that with pressure volume loops. This is a pressure volume loop during sinus rhythm, and the engineers know that this area of the volume against pressure is the work loop, and so the area of this loop is work performed by the heart, the stroke work. And you see that if you start pacing these four colors, the site of pacing actually is very important for determining the stroke work. These are all leads placed along the right ventricular septum. That's where you can get easily as a cardiologist. The brown one here is about in the apex. If you get a little bit higher, it's get a little bit better, but if you go very high, it sometimes gets very weird and very bad. So site of pacing is very important, but always you get a worse pump function if you start ventricular pacing. I mean, it's not terrific, you could say. You can lose 10% of your pump function, so who cares? Well, there are some major clinical trials showing some interesting things. This is a trial, the MOST trial was set up to prove the difference between the old-fashioned single chamber pacing, so with only a lead in the ventricle, pacing at a regular rate, and dual chamber pacing, the more modern device, where you pick up the rhythm in the atrium and then bring the impulse to the ventricle, with also the improvement that you synchronize atrial and ventricular contraction. So this was called physiologic pacing. As you see, in these patients with maintained conduction, the pacemaker is not always active at the time. So you have patients where you can read it out in the memory of pacemakers nowadays, who are being paced 0 to 20% of the time, or 20 to 30, or more than 40% of the time. If you follow these were like 2,000 patients, follow up over 2 or 3 years, you can score the relative risk of heart failure. You see that that risk is increasing with the percentage paced, that there is a difference, certainly in the low segment here, between the dual and the single chamber pacing, but if you get higher up, that difference is decreasing. So the surprising finding here was that it doesn't really matter which kind of pacemaker you have, but the more you're being paced, the higher the risk for heart failure. And so there may be a link between the moderate acute hemodynamic effects and the long-term outcome. And there are more studies are going on, so there are several factors that it looks like now that the propensity to develop heart failure depends on the percentage you are being paced. It's dependent on the duration of the QRS complex. Some patients have even wider QRS complexes because they have an infarction, for example. And it also dependent on the baseline state of your cardiac function. And a famous and most exciting, in a negative way, trial was the David trial. I think that was mentioned yesterday that nowadays, certainly in America, every patient with an ejection fraction below 35% gets an ICD, almost an implantable cardiac defibrillator. These devices can also do pacing, and this study, for one of your reasons, was designed to randomize patients, put the pacemaker on, or turn it off and let the rhythm of the patient come. The study was stopped prematurely after 1 year because there was a difference in mortality between the two groups, and it turns out the group with pacing had a significantly higher mortality within 1 year. So that was quite a sensational effect, and it was all related, although not truly proven, but it fits in the picture that the abnormal conduction of the heart is increasing the risk for heart failure and death. So what physiologists all know about this, you could say, how could they have continued the pacemaker companies and cardiologists in implanting these pacemakers and performing pacing like this? And well, this is not the only field where communication is not always too good, and so there must be some improvement in this field. So I will talk about measurements of normal and abnormal sequence of electrical activation, about measurements of deformation, and about modeling. And abnormal activation of the heart will be the topic, which is occurring during ventricular pacing, and that's iatrogenic, or in bundle branch blocks, part of the conduction system is diseased and that's acquired in the patient. So, but it doesn't really matter, it turns out both are equally bad. This is how you can measure activation. It's done in the 70s in the Netherlands. Durer had the opportunity to take human hearts after the patient had died suddenly for traffic accidents, take out the heart, let it beat in an isolated system, put 700 electrodes all over the place in the heart, endo and epicardial. And in those days, of course, there were huge amplifiers and heating up the whole university probably, and make paper recordings and measure it manually with a whole bunch of students, probably also feeding them donuts all day to do the measurements. What you get is these nice maps with nice synchronous activation along the left ventricular endocardium and spreading out quickly. It takes about 30 to 40 milliseconds to go from endo to epicardium, but the entire activation is finished within like 70 milliseconds. This is what we call synchronous activation, normal or physiological. They didn't do measurements, and I mean, measurements during ventricular pacing are surprisingly rare for a long time. Fasalo was one of the only people until recently performing measurements of ventricular pacing, and you can see here, and this is done with the mapping electrodes, putting the left ventricle under fluoroscopic guidance, and you could map the activation. This is within the left ventricle. The first activation occurs 65 milliseconds after the pacing lead in the right ventricle has started stimulation, so going from the right side of the heart to the left already takes 60 milliseconds, and then spreading out to the latest activated region is another 100 milliseconds. So you see how much slower it is compared to the 70 milliseconds in the normal heart. This is a more modern situation, the NOGA system. It's the same kind of mapping catheter, but now the guidance is done with a smart system of conduction coils, so you don't need fluoroscopy here. And you can map the activation, and you can make a nice color representation. This is the kind of the shape of the endocardium in the left ventricle. You see how the person is facing it in a cartoon-like fashion. You see the activation about the same spot at the septum and slow spreading to the lateral, posterior lateral wall. And it's also like 100 milliseconds difference from one side to the other. There's even a more modern fashion to do that. That is with the non-contact method, where you put a catheter in the ventricle with an inflatable net of electrodes, called like an olive-like device. It's not contacted the endocardium. It has 60 physical electrodes. The boundaries of the left ventricle are explored with another catheter and registered, and then you can extrapolate from these 60 electrodes to the endocardial surface at 3,000 virtual electrodes along the endocardium, and you can get also activation maps. It's a nicer way, although I'm not exactly sure what to do with it. This is one study where the two methods, the NOGA and the EnSight, as it's called, were compared, and you see there are differences in the pattern. These should be the same heart. Here the activation runs underneath, and here it's going transverse. So there's some differences here, and I'm not yet sure why this difference is. Maybe you pick up more signals with the non-contact method than with the direct measurements here. What we did in the animal lab in dogs is we put the basket electrode in the ventricle, and the basket contains 8 splines, and you can inflate that in this way like a double umbrella. You make contact with the endocardium, 64 electrodes, and you can map the activation, and then you can represent it as a bullseye plot. So with the septum at this side, lateral wall here, the apex in the middle, and the base of the heart at the outside. And you see that in normal conduction, the activation of this endocardium is quite synchronous. This is within like 10 milliseconds. And if you do right ventricular pacing, like at this spot, you see slow conduction around and a late activation at the lateral wall. If you pace at this lateral wall, the septum is being activated late. So you see the very gradual activation with this ventricular pacing. So that's the electric activation, and you could say, well, we knew all about that, so what's the surprise? Well, as a physiologist, we all know about excitation-contraction coupling, because the electrical impulse at every cell triggers a system of release of calcium, entry of calcium through the cell membrane, and calcium release by the cytoplasmatic reticulum, and the calcium being the trigger for contraction. So at every cell, you can see that the action potential in black here leads to calcium release and calcium increase in the myocyte, leading to contraction, development of force, which is the red signal. So there's a certain delay, but always one before the other. So if there is a time difference in electrical activation, you expect a time difference in contraction. And so the pacemaker, this is kind of a cartoon, should be seen as a mechanical device. And it's not only but it's battery-free pacemaker here, but also the heart beat, it's really beating up the heart, and it's a kind of representation of the mechanical effect. Now we've been studying this in the early days, a long time ago, with a technique developed by Theo Arts, with a video camera, old-fashioned video camera, putting white paper dots on the epicardium of dog hearts, and you can film the motion of these markers, and these markers were tracked semi-automatically with a computer program, and you could measure the strain on the epicardium. And these are the two sides I show here. You see that in normal conduction, sides A and B show kind of the same strain. This is the ejection phase here, so this is the systolic shortening, about the same. If you turn on the pacemaker, and in this case on the right ventricular outflow tract, you see that this side A is close to the pacing lead, it starts, it's activated early, it's also shortening very early, but then systolic shortening is smaller. And probably that's because this early shortening in this region leads to stretching in the remote zone, zone B. And the stretching, you see, increases the shortening in that late activated region, much bigger than it's actually prolonging beyond ejection post-systolic shortening. And you can all explain this by the classical Frank Starling effect. Stretching of a muscle cell increases sarcomere length and you get increasing force. It's the basic cardiac physiology. But now, on a local level, and you see that this very strong contraction here is kind of pushing back this early activated region, so it's impairing the contraction there. So you get a very complex contraction pattern within the heart. It's really discoordination. Well, this was in the early days, but cardiologists were not very impressed by paper dots on the heart. They like imaging techniques because you can see much more. So in some way, you have to go to imaging. And funny enough, the video technique we developed was meant to be the start of another tracking system, and that is of echo images. You can see this, we already saw the speckles in the echo image, and the idea of Theo 20 years ago was, well, you can follow those speckles and use them like the paper dots. And it lasted 20 years. We never succeeded in doing that, but nowadays companies, at least one, is able to take the echo image and track the gray level differences in the heart. You see that the dots here represent the tracking of the tissue and calculate strains from an echo image. I think this is a very promising technique, quite recently entering the field.
Which company is that? Which company?
It's the same one as the one who was making the engines on the KLM airplanes. Well, it's called General Electric, but they were not that smart. They needed a Norwegian company and to buy them. So it's the old thing that machine.
Actually, all the vendors have implemented versions of this.
Yeah, it seemed that they followed them. So. But we are very fond of this one. But this, in our lab, started only last month. And time in between, we spent a lot of time with MRI tagging. Well, I don't have to explain you this anymore since yesterday, but you see the lines and you can track these lines. You see the lines stick to the myocardium and you can calculate deformation. And this is what I've done initially in the lab at Hopkins with Elliot McVeigh. And this is what you see if you go through from base to apex through a dog heart with a right ventricular pacemaker. And you may notice from the motion it is like wobbling. Some people call it a hula hoop motion. Certainly not normal if you are familiar to the heart. You see the bending, especially here in this lateral wall, being very abnormal. And well, this during the first experiment was funny to watch how this looks like. You wonder what the strains are doing. And you can calculate all the strains in three dimensions, so very accurate fashion. And these are the strains you get, actually much more, but this is just an impression of all the data. You get all the regions along the base, along the apex, and you see that at the pacing side, this is the leveraging free wall, you see this early onset of shortening and a huge kickback in the strain, and here this huge pre-stretch and then amplified contraction. You see that these patterns change gradually over space, so every region is different. That's what you can tell from this, but it's, of course, this is too much information to understand, certainly for a cardiologist, so you need a better representation. And well, these are the tag images at three pacing modes, and Elliot McVeigh had already this fancy reconstruction with the endo and epicardial contours taken from the MRI images, and the strain represented in color. And so red is the original end diastolic length, blue is shortening, and yellow is stretch. And this is an early systolic image. You see the lines bending a little bit, so it's the onset of shortening, which is also seen in the blue color here. This is atrial pacing, the normal conduction. This is left ventricular pacing. You see the activation starts here. You see these lines are bending inward, and you see in the septum the lens, the lines are bending outward, and the opposite occurring with right ventricular pacing. And you see in color also the impressive changes. It gets even nicer if the movie can play. You follow them, and you really see the contraction patterns. These were really great moment when we saw these first movies playing. You see really the contraction wave, and the mechanical contraction wave, like being conducted through the heart. And well, this certainly impressed cardiologists, and I think at least it contributed to their understanding of that pacing is doing something very significant to the heart. Now we should come back. Well, this is just. But then you only see the motion, you see the strains. But what is strain? It's just a shortening of the muscle fibers. And you wonder whether these regional strain differences are really functional relevant. So we took these MRI images and we added left ventricular pressure measurements with an MR compatible pressure cap. And we constructed radial stress strain plots using these measurements of pressure, and we calculated cavity to wall volume ratio, and that's a very important factor, like in the Laplace equation, the wall thickness is relevant as well for stress, and the local strain as a third factor, and calculate stress strain loops during pacing. What you see in this bullseye configuration is the external work, so the area of this stress strain loop in these 192 regions in atrial pacing and ventricular pacing. In atrial pacing, you see that there's not very much difference between the different regions, but if you start pacing, it's going from black to like yellow, certainly in this case, and black means almost external work zero, because in these regions the early shortening occurs at low pressure, and then you get an figure eight shaped loop, and the net area of this loop is about zero, can be negative even. So it means that there's work being done on that piece of tissue. And in the late activated regions, you have the pre-stretch, and you get a bigger loop, and so the work can be twice as big as it is in a normal situation. So you really have a range of amount of work from 0 to 200% normal. So it is really a significant mechanical effect. And that's also evident for measurements of blood flow with microspheres, for example. If you see in these regions, I plotted here regions with increasing distance from the pacing site, and the blood flow is a little bit heterogeneous in the heart, also in the normal situation. But if you start pacing, blood flow drops about 20% at the pacing site, and it's increasing 20% at the remote site, and you see it's a gradual change from one to the other, similar to the mechanical work. You could say, is this ischemia? No, it's not ischemia, at least not at normal heart rate, because we didn't see changes in oxygen extraction or in lactate production. So there's also a redistribution of myocardial oxygen consumption, and there's no ischemia. And actually, this is 1994 when these measurements were done, but we have more recent data showing exactly the same. So it's really that the blood flow and oxygen consumption follow the changes in mechanical work. Yes?
So in these sort of more global measurements of lactate extraction, there could be endo and epi changes that might not be...
We measured from a local vein. Still, it's the total of endo and epi. But we have more evidence that there's presumably very little going on, because we have more recently also endo and epi measurements. And it's not likely. And these are, because this is mean blood flow, but we have endo and epi blood flows. And there's some differences, but they're not dramatic. And these are well within the autoregulatory range. So I don't think it's really very likely. I agree with pacing at higher heart rates, because then probably the asynchronous contraction limits the relaxation in areas so that there's an impediment of blood flow by the abnormal contraction, yes. But not at rates until 120 or something. But it's still a big dispute, and as we said yesterday, but this is my opinion so far. And on the long run, it's getting even more interesting, because these are dogs which we gave a pacemaker for 6 months, a regular good pacemaker, only with the lead implanted on the left ventricular free wall, and we made echoes. And you see on the echo already that the heart gets bigger, and that the wall gets even thicker at one end and thinner at the other end, which you see here. And it happens to be that this is the late activated region, the region which performs more work and get more blood flow. And you see there's local hypertrophy and there's thinning at the other side. And if you take out the tissue and you measure the myocyte size, indeed also the myocytes become bigger in this area. So you really see that locally increased workload leads to growth of the tissue. So there's a whole set of physiological adaptations. And you also may notice that the whole cavity becomes bigger, so the heart dilates. So far, it's clear that asynchrony looks funny, but it's not functional. And that's what we're going to realize now. And so what people have been doing since slightly more than 10 years is biventricular pacing. Instead of pacing from one side, do the RV and the LV together. And this is the MRI taking data we made in Baltimore. These are normal hearts, and this is the regular, as I showed you before, contraction pattern. This is LV and RV. You see the blue spots starting at both. With biventricular, you see contraction start at both spots. And if you go a little bit later in systole, these waves merge from the two sides. And you see at this stage, especially, this looks much more uniform, much more similar to the normal activation than the single side pacing. So this is really looking much better. So people were talking more and more about synchrony and asynchrony. And so we can measure also mechanical asynchrony when we have all these strains. These are the gray and the black are, black is left ventricular pacing. I took only half of the regions. This is the right ventricular apex. So the gray patterns coming from here. But in any case, if you take one piece of tissue and we measure the strain, this is the strain pacing when you pace from here. And this is the strain you get in the same region when you pace from the other side. And you can measure the kind of timing of the contraction in two ways, at least. You can measure the onset of shortening, which is in the black case very early with tagging. It's really about zero, because the tags need some time to be put into the tissue in the MRI scanner. So that's actually a little bit of difficulty. And you see the onset of shortening here is certainly later, more than 100 milliseconds later. Or other people use peak shortening, which is here or there, and the difference is bigger. So people are developing all kinds of measures from these strain patterns to express the degree of asynchrony. And we have been taking the onset of shortening in these same hearts during the three kind of pacing, you see that in atrial pacing, natural conduction, indeed also mechanical contraction is fairly synchronous. It's only a few isochrone lines. If you do pacing, you see this early activation here, and these are 20 millisecond isochrone lines. You see the spread of activation around the heart is again as this bullseye plot. And if you pace on the right ventricle, you see the activation go the other way around. Great pictures. That's what you see. And also we showed with some electrodes on the heart, which would localize that if you map or compare electrical activation with mechanical activation derived from the MRI, that is a fairly nice fit. The inaccuracies here are actually more the inaccuracy of accurately locating where this electrode was in the MRI scanner rather than the accuracy of the measurement. So overall, it really seems to be that electrical activation and mechanical activation, at least measured in this way, are similar, albeit, of course, that mechanical activation is always later. But then, what do we do with pictures? Well, we started to develop some, when we talked yesterday about how can you translate this to a doctor, and one of the solutions is making color pictures and show them, and the other is derive a measure of a single number, whether you want to know whether it's bigger or smaller than a certain value. Well, if you go to this certain number, we have been looking into two different things. One is the activation delay vector. If you have all the activation times, you can calculate local vectors of conduction of this mechanical wave, as it were, this sinus rhythm, and with pacing, the vector becomes bigger because it's going from one to the other side. So you can express this vector as an angle and the length of this vector, and that's expressing the asynchrony. You can also express asynchrony as the mechanical activation width, that's the time as we defined it, between 20 and 90% of all regions starting to shorten. And this mechanical activation time, of course, is shorter during atrial pacing than during ventricular pacing. So this is again the mechanical activation times, right atrial pacing, right apex pacing, and biventricular pacing. And you see that this length of this vector is in a normal heart about 20 milliseconds. It's becoming much bigger during right ventricular pacing, and it's getting back to almost normal, not entirely, with biventricular pacing. However, if you take this measure, the mechanical activation width, it's also increasing, but by far not as much. And biventricular pacing is not decreasing as much as it does with the vector. Mm-hmm. So it depends on the measure you use, what the result is that you get. From all the measurements, we think that this vector approach may be better, and may be better expressing the functional improvement. What's also important to notice, I think, nowadays, and I will show you, many people are using biventricular pacing, but in a normal heart, biventricular pacing is still worse than the natural activation. So anybody implanting a biventricular pacemaker in somebody without a conduction relay is doing harm to the heart. Not too much maybe, but it's not. You can better leave it out. So where it is useful, biventricular pacing, is in hearts with a conduction abnormality. The most well-known and most significant in the clinic is the left bundle branch block. So by infarction or just general fibrotic processes, the left bundle is not conducting the impulse anymore. And so what happens is that after the AV node, you have only the right bundle branch, you have an early right ventricular activation, and then a delayed left ventricular activation. And also within the left ventricle, you have a delayed activation. And what biventricular pacing is supposed to do is pick up this atrial signal, have the delay here in the pacemaker, and then activate both ventricles at the same time and resynchronize. In order to study that in more detail, we developed a model of experimental left bundle branch block where we go in with an ablation catheter through the aorta, you can derive an electrogram from the tip of that catheter, and then you can ablate the left bundle, which is actually a little bit higher up in the ventricle and pretty tiny. So this is quite a difficult procedure, but if you do it enough, you get pretty good success. And then immediately after ablation is successful, you can measure abnormal activation, wider QRS complex. And so we did a whole series of experiments where we did all the measurements we did before with pacing. So activation mapping with the basket electrode, flow measurements with microspheres, and strain with MR tagging. And you see that by making the bundle branch block, you see a wider QRS complex. The electrical maps show the asynchrony with the bundle branch block, similar to a right ventricular pacemaker. The strain, again, here the dark is low strains or even negative strains, or so that means stretching of the septum and increased shortening in the free wall. And the flow is also being redistributed. It's a little bit heterogeneous in a normal situation, but you see now that the septum flow is lower, about 20%, and it stays that way chronically, and chronic in our hands is 4 months of bundle branch block. And so then we said, how could we resynchronize best? What is the, because you can say, okay, we turn on a biventricular pacemaker, but there were already signs that that's not always the optimal way. And so we sat down and thought, well, how can you look into resynchronization from a physiologic, or at least logical approach? And the first thing we did is, okay, let's start with a simple picture. Let's start with thinking that we have an abnormal activation, that we still have the right bundle branch present, which activates the right in a good way and the left later. If we sense the atrial activation with a certain AV delay and pace only the left ventricle, you may get merging of the two wavefronts, like with biventricular pacing in a normal heart. But you can vary the AV delay in the pacemaker, so this left ventricular activation can come earlier and later than the intrinsic activation. And what would that do? And we came up with the following, and it is what Sander Verbeek developed in our lab. This is the normal situation in bundle branch block. You get an activation from the right, and you get spreading around the left ventricle. And this is actually more imagination. Well, the measurements supported this approach, and said, well, let's assume that this left ventricle is a circle, and that the conduction is going smoothly and uniformly from one side to the other side. Then we know that pump function is not good. That's why, at least it's the baseline pump function. We see there's activation within the left ventricle takes time, so we have an intra-ventricular asynchrony, which is a certain size. We also have a dyssynchrony between the two ventricles because the right ventricle is earlier than the left ventricle. We measure actually the right and left ventricular pressures, and there's a timing difference. So we have a certain timing difference, which we call negative if the right ventricle comes first, and so it has a certain value. Now let's assume the other situation, pace very early before intrinsic activation occurs, pace from the left ventricle. Then you have this situation. Now the left ventricular pacing is dominating the right. You've seen that from our previous work. You also see that this also generates an asynchrony. But now the left ventricle will start to contract earlier than the right, so you have a positive interventricular asynchrony, and probably almost the same, if the asynchrony is the same, a similar left ventricular pump function. And then with biventricular pacing, or with the pacing in the left ventricle, where the two wavefronts meet exactly in the middle, you expect the minimal intraventricular asynchrony and probably the best left ventricular function. And that's we assume a kind of linear change in interventricular asynchrony. So this is kind of a concept, and in this modeling session, this is kind of start of modeling, a very simple model. How would it work? So this is what we came up with. Well, then we could calculate also from the interventricular asynchrony where your optimal function would be. And this one is easier to measure than this one, because here you need these mapping electrode devices or MRI tagging or multi-tissue Doppler imaging, things like that. And this we can do with either two pressures or simple aortic and pulmonary artery valve closing times or so. So would this be working in a normal heart, and is this simple concept of resynchronization proper? Well, this is it. Data from a dog, and you see that with changing the AV delay with left ventricular pacing, you see this optimum left ventricular function. This is the DDT max is in the middle. This peak is indeed when the intraventricular asynchrony is minimum. That's so when the electrical activation maps shows the least asynchrony. And it turns out to be that really this optimum is where this interventricular asynchrony is in between these two extreme values. It's not zero, because zero in this case actually is here, but it's in between the two extremes. You see, this is the example of the two pressures. You see timing difference, 40 milliseconds in the rise time of the right and the left ventricular pressure, and here it's the other way around. And so with minus 11 in this case, you get the optimum resynchronization, so the best pump function. So this is the dog. And we were happy to have data from a PATH 1 study, which is one of the first resynchronization trials, 22 patients, and they were very invasive measuring right and left ventricular pressures. And so they did the same kind of measurements as we did. Actually, they did them before we did them. And we looked into those data. This is again a V delay with left ventricular pacing. You see this is the PDT as a measure of pump function. This is the pulse pressure, which is another measure of pump function. And this is this interventricular asynchrony. And well, these are signals from there. And it turns out that if you look properly, that again, this value halfway the two extremes for interventricular asynchrony are almost exactly at peak of both hemodynamic measurements. So if you plot one against the other, you see that this peak is very close to the actual peak. So the prediction of this interventricular asynchrony is pretty good with the reality. And so this simple concept seems to work in patients as well. And these were ischemic patients or non-ischemic, so they had about everything. You see that the range of interventricular asynchrony at baseline was huge. The range at the peak pump function was also huge. But for every patient, the measurement predicted the optimum setting almost exactly within six milliseconds. So you can vary, it seems like a good method to tune, to tailor the resynchronization for every individual patient. Because you see that if you set interventricular asynchrony to zero, you're certainly not at the best for all patients. There was another interesting aspect, is if you compare left ventricular pacing with biventricular pacing, which they also did in that study. And in half of the patients, 11 of the 22, biventricular pacing did not reach the same improvement as left ventricular pacing did. Whereas it seemed logically that biventricular would be the best of all, it was equally good in half of the patient, never better, but worse in the other half. And you can see why it is. If you plot interventricular asynchrony against DPDT, it follows exactly the same relation, but it cannot get further because with biventricular pacing, this is how far you can get. So you can even predict whether this biventricular pacing is good or bad. Modern pacemakers have the opportunity to pace the right and the left at different timing intervals. And that's the solution probably to get to this level by pre-exciting the left ventricle a little bit before the right ventricle. And when you're actually doing experiments showing that is indeed the case, and that you also can optimize that, they call it VV delay in these biventricular pacemakers. I think because of time, I skipped this one. Well, altogether, it's getting complicated anyway, And I think with modeling, things can become simpler. So another part of the research, together with Theo Arts, and this is the work of Roy Kerkhoffs at the Eindhoven University, is using modeling to understand what's happening with pacing. And so there was already a finite element model of the left ventricle, and especially for mechanical purposes with fiber orientation, as it was discussed yesterday, is very complex in the left ventricle with huge transmural differences. We knew all about that. And so that mechanical model was already present with muscle fibers with well-validated active and passive properties, and where you can calculate the contraction and all the strains using the equilibrium of forces. Roy added an electrical system to that, and so we had to play around how to do that. There are very complicated ways of calculating electrical activation, but because we are only interested in the depolarization, we used the Econo diffusion equation, and then the other modification which we did is to assume that conduction along the endocardium is quicker, and it's about up to 4 times quicker, which represents kind of the Purkinje system. And then you have to couple the electrical system to the mechanics at each site. As has been mentioned yesterday, any model is nice, but only if it's been validated. And so we validated the data of the model with data coming from the Baltimore group, Elliot McVeigh and Owen Ferris, and they had electrical activation data, which you see here, during left ventricular pacing, during right ventricular pacing. And this is the model data. And essentially, what we did is tune the electrical activation properties of the cells so that it matched as much as possible the measurements. And tuning means only changing the conduction velocity along the fiber direction and perpendicular to the fiber direction. And so we came up with physiologic data from that, and you see that the match between the two is quite reasonable. And if you represent it in 3 dimensions, with left ventricular pacing here, you see this elliptical spread of activation and going also around the ventricle. We also validated whether this model has good mechanics. And as you've seen, the strains are extreme, the changes in strains are extreme during ventricular pacing. So this is a very interesting validation. And as you see here, these are strains in different regions in the model during synchronous contraction, which gives really nice and normal systolic strains, as you know, but normal contraction seems an easy task. This is what you see with pacing in the model. And this is an experiment with from tagging data belonging to the electrical activation you've seen before. You see, this is the green is the early activated region, the red is the late activated region. Actually, this, for practical purposes, the reference point was set at the onset of ejection. That's why they look a little bit different than the previous ones. But anyway, you see that the late activated pattern was simulated quite reasonably from reality. Early activated region is a little bit less, but still you see the similarity, early shortening and stretching later on. But there's probably some work to do defining mechanical properties. But overall, the results look nice. This is another validation we did. We knew from previous work of Tamo Delhaas in the 90s that there is a relation between electrical activation time and circumferential strain during ejection. And so this is the model for all the different regions in the model, activation time and strain you can calculate, and this is this line. And these are data from 3 dogs from Baltimore, this one, this one, this one. This is the red line is again from the model. You see that 2 dogs are almost exactly on this line. One is deviating a little bit, but at least also that's a straight line. So we think that the model represents many aspects of the real heart during ventricular pacing. And what you can do then, of course, with the model is calculate stress strains, which we approached it in the measurements, but with the model you can really calculate the stresses and the strains. And this is what you get in an early, mid, and late activated region. The dashed line is the normal situation. They're almost equal in the different regions. And this is what's happening with pacing. In the middle region, you see a small change, but you see a huge increase in the stress strain loop. In late activation, the pre-stretching here, a little bit higher stress, and a huge shortening. And you see in this early activated region, in this case, we even see that the work loop runs completely in the opposite direction. So it's running clockwise rather than counterclockwise, expressing negative regional work. And so the model can go even further than the measurements, maybe by better understanding the mechanics of the paced heart. And this was in a single left ventricular model. And the next step, what Roy did, was develop a biventricular model and also based on real anatomy. So we got images, MR images, from a canine heart, and he contoured and used the contours at different levels of the heart to build this biventricular model using the finite elements we had before. And then you can simulate either left ventricular pacing or right ventricular pacing. And the black here again shows the slightly quicker conduction at the endocardium, and so this really looks like almost like a normal heart. And it should be beating as a normal heart. Oh, it shows only one movie at a time, that's interesting. Well, this is the paced heart. It shows the onset of shortening. So this is sarcomerelax now. The length of the sarcomeres is known in the model, it's set, and red is long sarcomeres and blue is short. So you see the filling, the heart gets about yellow, then the sarcomere length is about 2 to 2.1. And if it's yellow, then it starts contracting, and you see that late in the contraction, especially this region, the septum and the right ventricle turn red because the early contraction in the free wall stretches the septum. Yes?
Do you know what's used for the fiber model? What's where the fiber information is coming from for those models?
Theo, can you tell exactly?
Do you have the fibers?
There's fiber information presumably incorporated into these pacing models. Is that taken from histology data or DTMRI data? Just good estimates of what we know.
Fiber orientation, you mean?
Yes.
That is based on measurements by Hertz and by fitting an equilibrium, and so you can predict the fiber orientation. So it affects using adaptation rules to get fiber orientation.
Yeah.
So essentially, what has been shown in the past that stress distribution is very sensitive to fiber orientation, and so the basis was kind of measure fiber orientation and then let the heart adapt so that fibers settle, create a kind of uniform stress level, which seems reasonable in normal heart, and from that start pacing.
Yes, so is the fiber orientation changed through the heartbeat in the model?
And also the fiber sheet orientation
as well? Sheets are
not
in the model.
No, we have no sheets in the model. And the fibers probably change a little bit, but I don't.
Plus or minus 3 degrees, 4 degrees, about.
But their change is just driven by the displacement.
Yeah,
by the displacement. Yeah.
By the displacement.
Yeah. And how's the relationship between each fiber? I mean, they will interact with each other, but.
Yeah. Well, at that level, I don't know, because that's. We didn't analyze it.
Okay. Because through the wall, the fiber orientation changes almost 90 degrees.
Yes.
So there will be interaction between each other.
You have all kinds of shear
yes.
Deformations, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you incorporate the fiber orientation in the model, and the model become a very important issue for the stress distribution.
Mm-hmm. But essentially, the model, as far as I understand it, the fibers are allowed to slip along each other, to slide freely.
Mm-hmm.
That's so it's in that sense, it's still a fairly simplistic model.
I was wondering whether you had a chance to look at the Dostok effects of asynchrony in this model and its correction.
We didn't do that.
So,
I understand from Theo always that the strength of the model is in systole. So I'm not sure how far we can go there, but I see your part of that.
Also wondered whether in most forms of hypertrophy, the changes in the myocyte tend to be in a direction which would worsen the effects of asynchrony in terms of the speed of contraction and so on. Had any opportunity to look at the tissue properties in the hypertrophy region in your chronic?
There are several studies going on. There's some data, and most of it actually is from the group of Dave Kess in Baltimore, showing that indeed you have molecular changes and indicative of change. And actually, quite recently, but actually, the Helm will talk about this later. I think that also the fiber-oriented structure is changing during chronic disynchrony. So, but also tissue properties and also electrical properties are changing due to the chronic asynchrony. So this is representing acute effects in this model. And for long-term you need more complex changes. So again, to illustrate how the model behaves, these are just stills of the movie. For activation time, we, in this case, simulate the normal activation by a completely synchronous activation electrically and let the heart contract. You see the changes in the sarcomere length at begin ejection and the stroke work at every fiber or every node. With RV pacing, you see that this is early activation here and late activation there. And you see here the reverse with left ventricular pacing and the sarcomere length changes, so shortening and stretching, and stroke work also being lower and higher. And here's the opposite pattern. So all the data are quite similar to what you see in vivo. So, kind of supporting that the model is good. And one of the interesting things in the model is sometimes things are appearing which you didn't measure yet and still may be interesting, and that's also the role of the model, of course. And this, if you look at the hemodynamics from the model, this is the systolic pressure, the DPVT max, and the stroke volume, Q max, the maximum flow, for the left ventricle and the right ventricle. And it's a synchronous versus right ventricular and left ventricular pacing. If you look at the left ventricle, the maximum pressure hardly decreases with left ventricular pacing, but decreases with right ventricular pacing. DPDT max is hardly, actually a little bit higher with left ventricular pacing, but significantly lower with right ventricular pacing. And also stroke volume hardly decreases with left pacing, but does decrease with right ventricular pacing. Which is actually what we have been measuring in the dog model as well, that left ventricular pacing is not hemodynamically not as bad. It's not better, but it's not as bad as right ventricular pacing. That's what we know. And that's interestingly also shown by the model, which is consisting of all elements of the same property. We didn't see it, of course, in the single ventricle because it's symmetric. But adding the right ventricle to one side shows that indeed it matters where you pace in the left or the right. And so the difference must be interaction between the two ventricles. What's also interesting, if you look in the right ventricle, there you see that with right ventricular pacing, the right ventricular function hardly decreases. But left ventricular pacing does significantly deteriorate right ventricular function. So you get the best right ventricular function, or you lose the least with right ventricular pacing in the right ventricle and with the left ventricular pacing in the left. And we got back to the data of the animals, and it looks like also the animals show the same. And the right ventricle is almost unexplored in the whole pacing business. So this will be an interesting topic for the future. That's what I should. So my conclusions are that asynchronous activation is a condition that is both clinically relevant and scientifically tempting. Many aspects of this asynchronous activation can be explained and modeled by assuming relatively simple electrical conduction through the working myocardium and using kind of straightforward mechanical contraction properties. And as I showed you, the pump function of the heart is determined by intraventricular asynchrony, how synchronous are all the parts within the left ventricle, but also the mechanical interaction between the two ventricles. Well, as you've seen already, many of the people have been working with me within Maastricht on the animal work. Theo is appointed in both Maastricht and Eindhoven. This is where Roy and Peter Bovendiert contributed to the modeling. And here is the Baltimore group with a lot of MRI data. Thank you very much.